What could cause that? Clearly, aliens can cause that, as happened in Roswell, New Mexico, as happens in a television show I like called The Event. You have to face facts that aliens are all around us, and they have finally gotten to the NHL.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Creepy. That's what this is. You pointed out that I've spent a lot of time in Dallas, 20 years, working just a few blocks away from the grassy knoll, the book depository.
So you're a conspiracist.
And the conspiracy museum, which, oddly enough, has been closed down now. Conspiracy? Could be. Something odd is going on here.
Oh, well, I mentioned to you before we started the show that you I've been intrigued, and not in a titillated way, folks, but I've been intrigued by, and no pun intended, by the news of the last couple of days. This wave of celebrity nude pictures that got leaked to the internet. Hundreds of celebrity nude pictures that. The more I read about it, the more chilling and creepy it gets, because they talk about how it's part of some kind of, they think it's part of some kind of, like, underground hacker celebrity nude trading ring. There's a lot going on in that scenario. An underground hacker celebrity nude trading ring, which is just super, super creepy. But I was saying to Richard before the show started, it makes me even more nervous because I kind of warned about this on the Year in Review show, this Manti Te'o story last year. I feel like we're being herded into some kind of controlled internet situation, some kind of situation where the internet's going to be much more regulated and people are going to just blindly accept it because they've been conditioned to get ready for it over the last few years. So. You know, I know you said when we were talking about it earlier, you're not a techie. I'm not either, but, I mean, what do you think about all that might be going on?
Well, a couple of things. I'm not sure what's creepier, the fact that someone's actually hacking into the cloud and publishing these photos, or that these celebrities feel it's necessary to have these photos taken and then uploaded to the cloud. I mean, you know, what happened to a little bit of discretion and modesty? I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm a throwback to the, maybe I should have been born in the 30s or something, but not that that, you know, excuses what happened. But we're making things awfully easy for the National Security Agency. You know, I'm not a Facebook user. It's not that I have an aversion politically to it. It's not useful. It's not user-friendly. But I don't understand the need that people have when they eat a sandwich to take a picture, a selfie of them eating a sandwich and posting it. Or when they get drunk at a party, taking a selfie of themselves getting drunk at a party. I don't know. Maybe I'm wired differently. My mind just doesn't go there. That this is, I'm thinking people want to know this stuff. But obviously there are legions that do. But all of the stuff, intimate details of our private lives that, you know, was once only shared in a whisper across a dimly lit dining room table, is now out there for everyone to examine. So, you know, why are we, part of me thinks, so hung up about the NSA tapping our phones and our emails? We're giving them all this stuff willingly.
Yeah.
That's disturbing for me. That's the takeaway that I have.
Yeah, yeah. Well, people... That raises a whole other issue, and you kind of touched on it with people taking pictures of their food and stuff, and I've been sort of beating this drum for a while. It's frightening, just the, you know, you go to a bar, you get a beer, you look around, it's like, if there's 10 people at the bar, 6 or 7 of them are on their phone. They're just in the matrix, man. They've tapped out. It's scary. It's really scary, because you wonder what the hell the future's going to look like, because people are going to just be... Really, they can't deal with other people anymore in a face-to-face way. It's frightening.
No, and the follow-up from that is our sense of selves, our identity, is being scrubbed away. I think Marshall McLuhan had something to say about how technology scrubs away identity. And lost along with that is a sense of self and privacy. Like, if you don't have, you know, if there's no more... there's not a concept of I or me. We're just all these Borgs. Then there's no need for privacy. And I don't know whether you would call it evolution, or I'm inclined to call it devolution. But people of a certain age that are raised in the digital age, almost constitute another species. I think they're, and I'm not saying this in a pejorative way necessarily, but I am concerned. They're wired differently, and I can't finding it harder and harder. And I'm only 50. I'm finding it harder to relate to, say, people that are maybe 35 and under. When you try to have a conversation with some of them about, you know, why we need to be concerned about our privacy, and in some cases they just don't get it. They don't understand the concern because they really don't have a concept, I think, of privacy.
Yeah, yeah. And they make terribly dumb mistakes. It's, you know, like these celebrities, but also you were saying it's people. You can't imagine the number of times the police catch people doing the taking pictures while they're committing crimes or something like that. It happens all the time. It's like the stupidity of people is amazing.
Yeah, it reminds me of the you know, when you'd voice an objection to being patted down at an airport, let's say, for example. You know, this is a violation of my civil rights. And we talk about this on talk shows, and invariably people would call in and they would say something that irks me to no end. It was, well, if you've got nothing to hide, why are you worried about it?
Oh, that old argument. Yeah.
Yeah. And we all have something to hide. Every one of us. And we have a right to hide it. Now, it could be an incredibly banal thing, but my Lord, I mean, extend that logic. Okay, does that mean that you would subject yourself to a cavity search because you've got nothing to hide?
Yeah, yeah. It's, I don't know. I don't understand why people make that argument, but it's, I heard a good, you know, people need to, I heard a good quote from somebody the other day. We were talking about the, I don't want to get too deep into this Ferguson thing, but it was like someone was saying, you know, there are some, someone was reporting on the scene down there, and the other people were, like, sort of arguing with them. And it was like, just, you know, in situations like this, take the side of the person being pepper sprayed. You know, we'll figure out who was right and wrong after it's over, but, you know, the person maybe shouldn't be being pepper sprayed. Let's figure it out. Like, let's all calm down. Let's not be pepper spraying each other.
Yeah, you know, the there's so many different aspects of that story, too, but just the militarization of local police forces, you know, whatever happened to Michael Brown, you know, the reason, and I can't foresee a good reason why you would shoot an unarmed individual, but just the issue alone of the militarization of the local police, to me, is, it's, I mean, that's just front burner right now for me. That has to be dealt with.
Absolutely. Well, it's troubling. Is it that not? Because I lived in England for like 5 months, and I know how it's like. Sometimes it's kind of militarized in an official capacity, but then the local police, they don't carry guns or anything like that. But what's it like up in Canada? Because around here, it's like people really are kind of creeped out by the cops. You don't really want to, you know. It's not like the old friendly policeman situation. This is really like, at least for me, at least, you know, down here, people are just kind of like, you just want to stay away from the cops. Just don't run afoul of the police. But what's it like up there? Are people a little more trusting, or are they kind of coming to that same mindset?
Well, again, there is, I think, a little more respect and trusting in the authority, and I think by and large we have pretty good police officers that get into it for the right reasons. But it only takes a couple of bad seeds. You know, you may remember the G20 summit we had up in Toronto a few years back, and there were some egregious violations of civil rights, and there's more to come. I mean, the lawsuits are flying now.
Oh wow!
But thankfully, I guess we don't have the military hardware, you know, at the disposal of the local police. I mean, you know, we just don't have that kind of stuff lying around that our armed forces can afford to give it away to the local police.
Yeah, yeah.
So they don't have access to that. They're still using, you know, standard police-issued service revolvers. And in some cases, you know, if they're dealing with cigarette smugglers and so forth, they find themselves outgunned. But stuff like G20 bothers me. I remember, you know, there's nothing more dangerous than someone with a weapon that's just not that bright. And I remember Sarah Silverman had a line of a comedian, and she was stopped by a police officer. I guess she was speeding, and the cops saddled up to her car and asked her for her driver's license and registration, and then he looked in and he said, "Do you know why I'm here, ma'am?" To which she responded, "You got a C average in high school?"
That's great. You touched on something that I never thought I'd ask about, but it rung a bell for me. You mentioned cigarette smuggling. I remember the old pro wrestler Dino Bravo was mixed up in that, and they think that's why he was murdered. And it always confused me, because I'd never really heard of cigarette smuggling going on. So when it happened, you know, when he was murdered for being involved in cigarette smuggling, I was like, what is that all about? And then, you know, that happened like 15 years ago, so it kind of escaped my brain. Every now and again, it would cross my mind, but you just mentioned it. So what is this cigarette smuggling? Is this a big problem up there?
In certain communities, on certain border towns, I want to be careful. I don't want to, cast aspersions on our Aboriginal Canadian friends, but there is a small portion of the population that engages in this trade, this cross-border smuggling of cigarettes. They're making a killing. I mean, they're making a lot of money. And actually, in some instances, a lot of that money goes back into the community. So, you know, I'm kind of torn. In the Aboriginal community, they believe that the tobacco is a sacred plant, and it is given to them by their creator, and they should not be prevented from doing this, but unfortunately we have custom agents and laws and regulations, so we have this sort of this clash of the two cultures, and it can get quite violent at times, and there's a lot at stake, for the Aboriginal communities. As I say, it can be millions of dollars, some of which gets filtered into legitimate projects, you know, housing and community centers and so forth. But it's a problem for the local police because they are, in some instances, simply not welcome on the reserves, or it's kind of a jurisdictional kind of a conflict.
Weird. Now, how does that even work? Are they making like off-brand cigarettes up there and then sending them down here, or what is that all about? I'm still confused, like just about smuggling of cigarettes.
Yeah, I guess they're smuggling them across, ostensibly from the U.S. into Canada, not paying duty or anything on them.
Oh, okay, so they're coming from America. Oh, they must be like really expensive up there or something, then maybe.
Yeah, like everywhere else, I guess. But
yeah.
And I don't know if the traffic is both ways or not. That's sort of, in a nutshell, that's what's going on.
Weird.
And then they're just obviously offering them a discounted price. And in certain circumstances, some of these cigarettes they may have been stolen.
Yeah. There's probably all kinds of nefarious stuff going on there.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Now, we had a caller from the 585 area code, and then they dropped. So if you want to call back in, Rochester area caller, feel free to dial us up again. Now, tell me a little bit about the TV show, the conspiracy show on TV. Tell me a little bit about some of the topics you guys cover on that.
Yeah, we're just nicely into season 3, and let's see. Last night was the Obama birth certificate.
Ah.
We'd actually started making this episode a couple of years ago, so that's why it may seem like we're a little bit late to the dance. But that's always a hot topic. And we did an episode on the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and whether James Earl Ray was framed. I interviewed William Francis Pepper, who was James's attorney and also the attorney for Sirhan Sirhan. We have an episode. It hasn't aired yet in season 3. It's on Stanley Meyer's water engine.
Oh wow!
Whether it's possible to create an internal combustion engine that runs essentially on what they call hydroxy, which is sort of a a different state of hydrogen. It's not just hydrogen gas, but it's the electrons are spun in a particular fashion so that it actually constitutes another state, not a gas. And that was Stanley Myers' claim, that he was able to somehow, using some pulsed wave, electronic pulsed wave, he was able to spin the electrons in the hydrogen atom in a certain way. And he made these YouTube videos where he was seen driving his dune buggy across America on virtually nothing but water. And then he died under rather mysterious circumstances, which led some to speculate that it was Big Oil, of course, after him.
Yeah.
We did an episode on that. John Lennon, whether Mark David Chapman was a Manchurian candidate. We did an episode on we called it the fake Arab Spring. The idea that these so-called spontaneous populist uprisings in places like Morocco and Libya and Egypt were anything but spontaneous and populist, that they were manufactured by outside forces, whether it was, NGOs from America or NATO intelligence, that instigated these clashes in order to institute or bring about a regime change in these countries and install or create a client state, basically.
Yeah, destabilize the whole region.
Right, right.
Interesting. Right. Now, how do you decide on what topics to cover? We'll get meta on this a little bit. You know, take us into sort of the war room, if you will, of putting it together.
Yeah, I wish I had a better story to tell you. I sit down at the beginning of the season and I look back. Okay, what have we covered so far? What haven't we covered? What's happening right now that has some currency? And I want to make sure that it's kind of balanced. If I'm doing 13 episodes, let's say, I want to have a certain number of sort of geopolitical content, whether it's the Arab Spring. I want to have some real, hard conspiracy type stuff. I think like Stanley Myers or Martin Luther King Jr., 9/11 stuff. I want to service a wide audience, so I want to include some UFO stuff, some paranormal stuff if possible.
Yeah.
And we'll go out and we'll shoot maybe, probably twice as many episodes as we need. Go into a city and try to maximize, because this is a Canadian production to keep in mind, so we don't have a lot of money to throw around. We try to maximize efficiency. So if I go into a place like New York, I might work on 5 or 6 episodes simultaneously because I know that those people are in New York.
Right, right.
So I may end up working on some episodes that don't even get aired in that particular season.
Interesting.
That's pretty much how it happens. It's a real kind of guerrilla television in the sense that we're, very low budget, flying by the seat of our pants, and I'm proud of the show, the resources that we have. It's been a long, arduous journey, but here we are, season 3, and as I say, we're now in the U.S., parts of Europe, and Africa.
Wow! Nice, nice. Yeah, Adam Gilreilly says he was filmed for the show, so I'm not sure what episode that is.
A couple of years ago, I met Adam in a travel lodge in Inglewood, California, stone's throw from the airport, and we did it in my hotel room, the show, I mean. let's see, we talked about Jim Morrison. That episode is airing this season. We talked about John Lennon. That's airing this season.
Oh, wow.
And I think we did one more. It'll probably come to me after about 3 o'clock in the morning. I think we did three episodes with Adam. And then after that, I went down to Coronado, just off the coast of San Diego, and I met Alan Graham, and interviewed Alan, who was Jim Morrison's brother-in-law for the episode.
Oh, wow. That sounds pretty cool. Now, did I see on your on the list there? You also did an Oak Island episode. I had the opportunity to go out there and check it out. It's pretty. It's quite the story. It's really enchanting. The whole tale.
That's my Canadian content. I wanted to include sort of a uniquely Canadian story, and Oak Island is arguably the most expensive and the longest running treasure hunt in history.
Mm.
They call it the Money Pit, and it's just a little tiny island, a collection of oak trees in Mahone Bay off the coast of Nova Scotia, and there are dozens of islands. Now, what makes it interesting and sort of feeds into the skeptics or the debunkers is that there are formations in that area, just given the topography or the geography, that gives rise to a lot of sinkholes and has led some to believe, oh, it's nothing but a sinkhole. But I don't buy that. I mean, if you look at the way this thing was constructed and, you know, dating back to the late 18th century when a couple of kids, you know, saw this, what looked like... you know, some sort of an engineered pit that had been dug, and they dug down a few meters, and they ran into some timber, and then got the timber out of there and dug down some more, and then they found some more timber. I mean, timber that had been cut.
Yeah.
You know, rampant speculation. What's down there? At one point, a stone, engraved stone, apparently was found, which has been lost to the ages, but the stone was supposedly translated, and it said something to the effect, 500 feet below lies, I don't know, 4 tons of gold or something like that. So the speculation is that it was pirate plunder, or it was the Knights Templars plunder.
Yeah.
The Visigoths. Some have even speculated it's the final resting place of the Holy Grail and the Ark of the Covenant. The transcripts of the original transcripts from the real William Shakespeare, not William Shakespeare, but the person who actually wrote those plays. So it's a great story. It's got all the, you know, it ticks all the boxes. There's intrigue,
yeah.
There's mystery, there's controversy. And I spoke to a woman, Lee Lamb, who actually lived on the island with her family back in the late 50s, early 60s.
Oh, wow.
Her father and brother were hired to try and excavate and dig down and find the treasure. And in fact, her father and brother ended up dying as a result, fell into a pit, and were overcome by toxic fumes. So it's kind of a sad story, but remarkable tale. I'm really pleased with that episode.
Did you get the chance to go out onto the island at all? I know I think it's only open, like, I think it was closed for a while since I went up there. And then now they're kind of reopening it again a little bit. But I don't know if you got the chance to actually get out there.
No, I tried. It's privately owned.
Yeah, they're really on lockdown, like, otherwise. Yeah,
yeah, you need, it's almost like, you know, you need a special visa to get on there. You've got to you know, write months in advance and ask permission and so forth. And I think as we speak, I think there's another group, another firm that's been hired to try and excavate. The problem is it's been messed around with so often that, you know, a lot of those original sort of tunnels that were designed kind of as a booby trap so that as you dug down so far, you would allow the seawater from these inlets, these carefully dug inlets, would flood the shaft with water. So you could never get down to the bottom. But there's been so many excavations, you know, people would bring massive equipment and backhoes and things on there. I think they've damaged the original structure. So I don't know that they'll ever be able to recover what may lie at the bottom. But to answer your question, no, I wasn't able to get on the island.
Yeah, I think they open like, now I think they're open like 3 weekends a year in the summertime. I know when I went up, it was like 1 weekend a year. But it's funny. We talk about the UFO community and the conspiracy community. Even that community is beset with infighting and civil wars and strife. So you know, go ahead.
It's amazing, isn't it? I guess that's just part of who, you know, being human, that when we sort of organize around a particular issue, it's just a matter of time, before these factions sort of break off and start fighting each other.
Yeah. Well, I heard the idea proposed when I was up there. That was 2007 when I was visiting there. A couple of kids from, I think, MIT gave a presentation. They suggested, I don't know, it's some kind of new technique. Actually, they were going to use it at Fukushima. I don't know if they did or not. But it was like they put a ring around the money pit of, like, long poles, long pipes.
Right.
And then they freeze freeze the, they fill them with water and like freeze it, essentially create a giant ice cube, and then pull the whole thing out. But I don't know if they ever, obviously they never did it, but I think that might be the most intriguing possible way to get to the, literally get to the bottom of the money pit.
My gosh, I can't imagine how an endeavor, how much an endeavor like that would cost.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe I could pull it off if I just had all the pipes.
Well, good luck to you.
Yeah, shove them in the ground. But yeah, so I don't know if did you ever see the TV show they made about it? They have a reality show. I have mixed feelings about it because I love Oak Island. One of my favorite stories, but it really wasn't the kind of story that was crying out for a reality show.
No, yeah, to me that's like I don't know, putting an amusement park in Dealey Plaza.
Right.
Just
yeah,
some things
exactly.
Are just best left alone, and we can revel in the legend, you know?
Exactly. I wouldn't be, that said, I wouldn't be adverse because they have a very gorgeous resort out there right next to Oak Island, so I wouldn't be adverse to them just building a resort on the island if they're going to give up on digging for it, so who knows. But I have a feeling it's ironic, but you talk about empires rising and falling earlier. There's the Oak Island sort of empire. Eventually, I think the people who have it will eventually get sick of it and kind of give it up, and it'll fall into someone else's hands, and it'll continue onward that way, you know, with a different ownership group.
Oh, no doubt. In fact, there was a rumor several years ago, well, not several, maybe more like a 10 years ago, that Martha Stewart attempted to buy the island. Now, I don't know that, you know, she had... in mind that she was going to recover the treasure. I just think that she wanted some nice, relatively inexpensive oceanfront property. I'd heard that legend or that rumor, and it's true. I mean, Atlantic Canada for the try to buy a nice acre on Martha's Vineyard, you can't do it. But there's tons of oceanfront property still to be had at reasonable prices in places like Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island.
Yes, I have family on Prince Edward Island.
It's a
fantastic place.
I've let the cat out of the bag, and now all these American real estate speculators will be rushing off and buying my country.
Well, I don't know. Have you ever heard this whole thing? I don't know. As I said, I have family up in Prince Edward Island, so when my immediate family would go up there and visit, My family up there were very upset because they claimed that the Americans were stealing all of the water from Canada. Is there something going on where Americans are importing the water from Canada or something?
Well, we had the North American Free Trade Agreement, that was always kind of a contentious issue politically up here.
Mm-hmm.
This happened the final agreement was signed in 1988, and whether or not water was part of that agreement that we would make available some of our water, and it's sort of denied by it was denied by Brian Mulroney, the Prime Minister at the time, as I recall, that no, fresh water wasn't on the table, and we're not giving our water away, but that doesn't preclude other. Other sort of side deals from happening apart from the North American Free Trade Act. But, I don't know. We have more fresh water up here than anywhere else in the world. And, as far as I know, we're not suffering any of the drought we are in the Northwest. It's just been horrible. Why wouldn't we make some of that water available to our American friends?
It's funny. This guy, Red Son Superman, he just got into the chat room. He missed the first hour of the show. He wants me to ask you why half of Toronto is under construction this summer. So I guess it is the prevailing theory on all that. Interesting. Now, one thing I've always kind of been interested in as far as Canada goes is, like, with America, it seems like they just take over everything as far as space goes. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's still some unsettled parts of America, but people are just everywhere. But when you look at Canada, there's that huge portion that just kind of keeps growing upwards. What's up there? What's going on up there?
What's going on? Well, yeah, it's true. I mean, our population we've got about 35 million souls here in Canada. And here's the secret why Canada will never be annexed by the United States, because the last thing, for example, a Republican president would want would be 35 million registered Democrats suddenly, you know, brought into the United States fold. I am not a registered, or would not be a registered Democrat, by the way. But our population, about 90% of it or more, is just strung along the Canadian-U.S. border, like this ribbon that just, you know, goes from coast to coast. And once you get, let's say, 200-300 miles north of there, I mean, it's virtually uninhabited. It's, you know, just as far as the eye can see, boreal forest and Canadian Shield. And then ultimately, of course, when you get past the tree line and into the permafrost, it's just a lot of ice and snow.
Yeah. Do you think
we really do need to develop our northern frontier? You know, we have I think we're very generous to our immigrants that come to this country, and you know, if I always say, for people who are willing to come here and work and contribute, then the more the merrier. We've got all kinds of room. But I wish there would be more of a concerted effort to try and encourage newcomers to this country from wherever they come to settle in the northern regions. You know, we need to start exploiting some of the resources up there that are untapped. You can't sustain a country as large as this. You cannot build infrastructure, you know, from coast to coast with such a small tax base.
Mm.
35 million people. I mean, we're a small, you know, such a small number of people in such a vast, uninhabited land.
Yeah, it's remarkable because, you know, like I was saying, a big part of it, the expansion of the population in America is just the, as you said, exploitation. People want, you know, they found that gold in California. Next thing you know, it was just this mad rush to get out there. It's surprising there hasn't been sort of this just mad rush to get up in there and into that area, even though I'm sure it's treacherous, but you know, it's 2014, I'm surprised. Just the sheer sort of, like, the human condition of trying to get blood from a stone, trying to get, you know, especially the business end of things, the economic end. I'm surprised we haven't seen this mad rush just to get up there and be the first to find whatever, you know, could possibly be exploited and utilized by big business.
Right. I mean, and I'm sure there are, you know, countless environmentalists out there who would be listening to what I'm saying and, you know, would want to hit me upside the head with a sock filled with horse manure, saying, no, leave our pristine forests alone and so forth. But I don't know. I'm one that believes that the earth was given to man, you know, to use, not to abuse, but to use and to manage. We should be good stewards of the earth, certainly. But, you know, for the good of all of us, we need to be able to exploit, you know, the resources and what's there. But it is many, you know, it's very, it can be inhospitable once you get up there, you know, the black flies and the cold and so forth. These are not easy working conditions by any stretch.
Well, it stands to reason, it seems like Canada has a very healthy Bigfoot culture. So it stands to reason maybe that there's a lot of creatures and stuff hanging around up there we don't know about either.
Yeah, I did a show on my radio program a couple of weeks ago just about Bigfoot sightings in Ontario, and just about 3.5 hours north of here is Algonquin Park. It's this beautiful provincial park, and I think there have been about 200 Bigfoot sightings in that park alone, and some pretty credible sightings too. So, yeah, I would agree. I mean, if there's any place where Bigfoot would be found, I would think it would be, you know, these vast stretches of boreal forest that are virtually uninhabited. I mean, you could sustain a pretty healthy breeding population up there for sure.
Now, just to get meta again on the whole thing, do you think that the whole thing being the paranormal and everything, like I said, we've both been looking at this for a very, very long time, and I've I apologize, too, in a sense, because I'm a very cynical person. You probably may have picked this up by now. I'm very sort of like, with this whole thing in a lot of ways. I find it frustrating, but also very interesting that all these mysteries are out there. And as far as I can recall, being in this field, like, I don't remember any ever, like, being solved. It's really remarkable in a way, you know? You can go back to, like, the 70s and 80s mysteries that are still floating around, you know, like Amelia Earhart and crop circles and cattle mutilations. You don't hear much about anymore, but they're still mysteries, and they still haven't been solved. So it makes you wonder what's really going on with this paranormal thing. Why can't we close the deal on any of these?
Well, you know, when we're talking about paranormal or supernatural, you know, someone the other day sent me an email with a quote from a scientist talking about how, you know, within the light spectrum, you know, there are wavelengths that we cannot perceive with the optical nerve, and there are acoustical waves that we can't perceive with the ocular nerve. So, you know, what's to say that there aren't these subtle energies out there that are just as every bit as real as ultraviolet or you know, whatever frequency you wanted to talk about that's beyond human perception. Just because we can't perceive doesn't make it any less real. And if we're not necessarily looking for it, and therefore sort of attenuating an instrument, I suppose, to sort of record that or to pick it up, we're never going to find it if we're not necessarily looking for it. So I'm a great believer in the unseen world for that very reason. I just because we can't measure it yet, because we don't have an instrument capable, doesn't mean it's not every bit as real as what we can see and hear and feel and touch.
You touched on something that I've kind of thought about too and talked about on the show. It's like you wonder if as a species, if we're even capable of being able to grasp these mysteries. You know, it's like I'm colorblind. Some colors I just can't see right. So if you wonder if just as a species, if we're just paranormal blind.
That's an excellent analogy, yeah, for sure. But as to, you know, Bigfoot, you know, habeas corpus, you know, where's the body? One would suspect after all this time we'd have some prima facie evidence other than just a series of countless blurry photographs. But as Mitch Hedberg once pointed out, maybe Bigfoot is blurry.
Yeah, maybe. I've said.
I'm just as cynical as you, Tim. I'm just as cynical as you. But there's a difference. You see, we're skeptical, we're cynical, but we're not debunkers.
Right.
A debunker is just someone who, even in the face of evidence, of, you know, credible evidence, just shuts down. It's almost I think it's a kind of a survival mechanism, and we all have a little bit of that in us. But they're not skeptical. You know, the skeptical inquirer. There's a few members of the skeptical inquiry group that are skeptics, like Joe Nickel. But by and large, they're just debunkers.
Yeah. Right. I'm cynical, but I'm on the team of. I'm on our side, you know what I mean? It's like I'm cynical because I want things to be done better. I'm cynical because I want this thing to come to a resolution, some of these mysteries. So
yeah, you're it sounds to me like it's not so much cynicism as frustration.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I share that.
Let me see. Someone just said lost sound in the chat. I think we're okay though, so we're gonna keep going here. Well, what do you make of this? It's funny too, because I find a fascination with the 9/11 story, because it was born and evolved and everything. And so this year we also saw the birth of this new mystery. Who knows when it'll be solved? This MH370, the missing plane thing. Do you have any thoughts on that whole thing? Because I found it really, really interesting.
Yeah, I've got all kinds of thoughts on that, and I've done a number of programs on Malaysian Airlines 370. I found it very interesting that there's a group of islands just north of Diego Garcia, which is kind of Well, I believe at one time it was a British protectorate, this island in the South Indian Ocean, and then all the British residents were kicked off, and now it's kind of a joint U.S. and a British Air Force base, very tightly guarded and very secretive. And there's a group of islands just north of the Diego Garcia, and the name, again, escapes me, but the day that 370 disappeared, there was about a dozen farmers located on different areas of the island who all swore and corroborated each other's stories that they saw a very large aircraft, which sort of fit the description of a 777, flying at low altitude overhead in, you know, flying essentially in a westerly direction, which is the exact opposite place we're told it went down. And then Diego Garcia claims that on that very day, they claim their radar was shut down for maintenance. Now, you know, I've talked to enough military people over the years to know that, you know, an installation like Diego Garcia would never in a million years leave itself so vulnerable as to, you know, shut down its radar system for the entire day. That just does not happen.
Yeah.
So, you know, why did Diego Garcia say that? And what did those islanders actually see flying in a westerly direction? So there's a lot of misdirection happening with 370. I think the best explanation I've heard, and one I think has a great deal of credence, is that 370 was taken up to about 40,000 feet. We know it did that, and people were scratching their heads as to why. At 40,000 feet, the plane would basically now my ignorance with aeronautics is coming out here. Decompress, is that the term you would use?
Yeah. Yeah, the oxygen would like
depressurize.
Run
it would depressurize, right? So at that altitude, it would the cabin would depressurize, the oxygen masks would come down, and after about 15, 20, 25 minutes, everyone would just sort of drift off asleep and would asphyxiate, die. And then this plane is flown west, and people were saying, well, it couldn't have landed on the ground. You know, where you need a lot of runway to land a 777. Well, if you go onto Google Earth and you look at places like Yemen or Somalia and Somaliland, and Somalia is basically governless at this point. It's just completely lawless, that place. There's nobody in charge. And there are dozens of abandoned, very long runways, airstrips in Somalia. It's not too hard to contemplate that 777 could have been rerouted and flown to a place like Somalia, landed, the dead passengers taken off to be used perhaps by some future, I don't know, black ops or some terrorist organization. The payload capacity on the 777 is staggering, combined with its long distance flight capability. You could fly just about anywhere in the world. You could put some dirty nuclear material on that plane, fly it over New York, dump it, make New York inhospitable or uninhabitable for 100,000 years.
Yeah.
Totally paralyze the U.S. economy. You could put a small nuclear device on there, detonate it somewhere over the United States in the upper atmosphere, and cause an EMP.
Hmm.
That's my thinking. It was commandeered for use as in some future project, shall we say.
Mm. I definitely think something nefarious is going on with it. And I think part of me, I think there's some kind of connection here with the other Malaysian plane that got shot down. I feel like, because I introduced the idea, I'm sure I didn't introduce the idea, you know, to the world, but I introduced it on my show in discussion that maybe the original first plane that went missing was some kind of message from the United States to Russia, because that's when all that upheaval in the capital, the Ukraine there, all the upheaval.
Yep, yep, yep.
I felt like maybe I sort of threw it out there. Maybe this is a message by the U.S. government while Russia was taking over part of Ukraine that, you know, hey, look what we can do, guys. We can make a plane disappear, so just chill out. And then next thing you know, like 6 months later, another Malaysian airline goes down, courtesy of Russia, and it was like maybe their response back where it was like, you know, hey, man, let's look what we can do. Like, I feel like there's got to be some kind of – I find it too coincidental that there was two Malaysian airlines that were involved in these major world events in 1 year. I feel like maybe there's some underlying message or tit-for-tat going on that we're not privy to.
And actually, if you just look at the 777 alone, less than – I think it was only a couple of weeks after 370 disappeared, there was a 777 that was intercepted. It was flying towards Copenhagen. There was some sort of a summit with a lot of – I think it was kind of an anti-nukes organization, which included President Obama and a number of other Western leaders – were meeting in Copenhagen, and this 777 was flying into restricted airspace and had to be, as I say, had to be intercepted and escorted out of there.
Oh, weird. I've never heard that.
I can't remember if that was a Malaysian airline, but it was definitely a 777, and when I heard that, my ears pricked up, and I thought, aha, is that the project they had in mind? But luckily, nothing happened. But the thing with the Malaysian airliner that went down in Ukraine, and I'm not convinced yet that the Russians were responsible for that.
Hmm.
Not that I think Putin is an angel or anything, but I think the idea of portraying him as another Hitler is patently absurd. Imagine, you know, how would the Americans respond if the Russians decided to put nuclear missiles, and that's what this is about. NATO wants nukes in Ukraine, you know, nobody could abide that. You know, if you're president of Russia or president of the United States, you can't allow someone to put nukes in your backyard. And how would the Americans respond if Russia tried to put nukes in Cuba? Oh, wait a minute. I've seen that movie.
Yeah.
I remember how that one ended. So, but there's definitely something going on. I think George Norrie interviewed somebody who may have been in touch with some Russian military people and someone on the ground who saw the bodies, and he commented that and these are the passengers aboard the airline that went down in Ukraine, commented that the bodies looked like they had been dead for a very long time.
I remember hearing that, yeah.
And I thought, wait a minute, is it possible that the passengers from 370 were somehow, I don't know, kept on ice? And then they used that same plane, flew it over the Ukraine, shot it down to use it some sort of a pretext for war. I don't know. But
yeah.
Then I thought, wait a second. If they're willing to kill all of those passengers the first time, they're not going to bother keeping the bodies. They'd have no problem shooting another plane down and killing more innocent people.
Hmm. Right, and then if I saw the arguments that maybe that plane that crashed or got shot down was the first plane, but then you still stuck with another missing plane because then you're like, well, what happened to the second plane?
Exactly. And those passengers.
Right.
Yeah. In some respects, I think World War III has already begun, and it's been going on actually for many, many years. But it's all wars are fought very differently now. We fight wars by attacking other countries' stock markets and try and destroy their economy or currency wars and so forth. And then sometimes the fighting spills out onto the main stage, and we catch kind of a glimpse of it. But we don't understand that it's a war. We think it's simply some air disaster, or it's an earthquake, or it's poor Princess Diana was killed in a car accident because of a drunken chauffeur.
Right.
But are these actual acts of war that just sort of spill out onto the main stage?
That's an intriguing idea. That is very intriguing, because I think you're right. There's a lot of stuff that happens. That they wouldn't want us to know that was going on. You know, like there was a huge blackout, I think, like after 9/11. I forget, in New York or something like that. Who knows? I mean, I didn't really find out what the story with all of it was. But it seems like the news, they immediately want to be like, it's not terrorism, don't worry. So then you have to be like, all right, dude, what's really going on here?
Yeah, there's a great deal of stage managing going on, and backstage.
Yeah.
We're sitting out front in the front row watching the show and just totally oblivious to what's going on back there in many respects.
Yeah, we're left fumbling trying to figure out trying to put the pieces together as things happen. Now, we're near the end of the program. I just want to take a couple of minutes here, and much to the chagrin of the listeners. Give me a little update here on your Toronto Blue Jays. What happened? I thought they were in the mix there for a while, and they've really fallen off few weeks.
I had great promise too, but early on, of course, even Tampa Bay and Houston probably were thinking World Series. But it's the old injury bug. We lost Encarnacion, who was our big run producer. I mean, there were weeks when he was carrying the team on his back. He went down for a prolonged period of time. A pitching staff that once again looked amazing on paper turned out to be pretty mediocre. And then also the injury bug there. We lost Brandon Morrow. He just got he's back on the roster after being on the DL for most of the season, and he was supposed to be, a pretty solid number two or three starter. R.A. Dickey has once again been incredibly mediocre. There goes the season. Encarnacion, Batista was injured for quite a while. Brett Laurie, a pretty talented infielder, plays some second base and some third base and has a pretty good bat. He's lost for the season. So not enough pitching depth, and when you're relying on the long ball, I mean, this is not the 83 Orioles. We don't have those kind of guys that can hit them over the fence night after night after night. That it's streaky, right? You need good defense and pitching, and we didn't have it.
Yeah. Well, as a Boston fan, I can't say I'm pulling for them, but I do feel bad for them. So, because everyone else has gotten to the dance here in the last few years. Even Baltimore broke through. Look at Baltimore. They're on fire this year. So even Baltimore is going to make it back to the playoffs this year. And Toronto is still kind of knocking on the door here. And it's becoming quite a long drought here for them to get into the playoffs.
It's been 20 years at least since we played a meaningful game past the All-Star break. But this year, I think we sort of turned a corner this year. We were still competitive into mid to late July, here we are end of early September, and we're still not mathematically out of it. So that's something, I guess. I take some solace in that. But we've got a pretty good farm system and a lot of talent, and I think a pretty savvy GM. So hopefully he kind of was stand pat this past year. Hopefully he'll make some deals and we can turn this thing around.
Yeah, as we say in Boston, there's always next year.
Yeah, and then the year after that, and then, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm growing old. I want to see one more before we go.
Well, it seems like every year there's a team that bubbles up to the surface again. So this year it's Kansas City, and like I said, Baltimore's sort of back in the mix again. So it's cyclical. So hopefully we'll see what happens. I'll have a lot more to talk to you about about baseball when we get you on the baseball show next spring. So
well, Tim, you've had plenty of reason to celebrate the last decade or so with the Red Sox. So I mean, it's been a feast.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's been ups and downs. We're in the cellar again this year. We were in the cellar a couple of years ago, and we won last year. It's a very schizophrenic period for people. So they're already, but we're already looking forward to next year. So we picked up some really good talent in the last few weeks. I'll be interested to see how things shape up next year with these two Cuban guys, or whether they flip them for that guy from the Marlins. There's a lot of people really seem to think that they're going to try and make a run at that guy. So we'll see.
Well, I'm on a mission to take my boys to all 30 ballparks in the major leagues, and I was just down in New York, took them to Yankee Stadium. Next on the list is Detroit, and there'll be a trip out to Chicago, whip off a couple of there, St. Louis, or Cincinnati, Cleveland, Minnesota, Milwaukee, all in the neighborhood. So
Nice.
Yeah, that's my game plan anyway.
That sounds awesome. Well, let me know when you make it to Fenway. I'd be happy to host you guys here at the place.
That's a date. You got it, my friend.
Yeah. Have you ever been to a game at Fenway?
I have not.
Oh, you love it.
I'm sure. Oh, I mean, it's a shrine. It's, you know, there's Wrigley, there's Fenway, and that's about it. That's all that's left standing. I mean, the new Yankee Stadium is wonderful, by the way. But
oh, sure.
None of the history, of course, of Fenway or Wrigley. So.
Well, we're in the final minute here, and if we run over a little bit on the plugs, that's fine because the thing will keep going. Tell me, folks can check out more at richardsurrett.com. That's pretty simple. Richard, and you spell Surrett, Syrett.com. It's The Conspiracy Show. It's Sunday nights, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on AM 740 and a whole bunch of affiliates. And it's also, you can stream it, right, through richardsurrett.com, so people can check it out there as well.
It's a live stream, and then there's the podcast as well, and then the TV show is, the website for that is theconspiracyshow.com. And as I say, 52 episodes now available in the U.S., so they should be playing from, you know, many parts of the country. Not, we haven't blanketed the U.S. yet, but we're getting there.
Nice, nice. And folks, just check it out. This stuff's awesome. And I really, I got to thank you, Richard. First of all, we're going to lose the audience in a moment. So first, let me thank the live audience for tuning in and the folks in the chat room. Thanks for the heads up on various technical mishaps. Thanks for tuning in, my friends. And they are off now. I just want to thank you once again, Richard. I really do appreciate it. Loved the conversation. You're of the like mind with me. You know, you really cover all these different mysteries. They're all so fascinating. And to be a specialist on one thing, you miss out on so much other fun stuff. So I really appreciate that you're kind of in the same camp that I am, where it's like, what's this? Was Jim Morrison, do you think his death? Is there, you know, are there alien tests going on at the Dulce base? What's this latest conspiracy theory surrounding MH370? It's, you know, the whole milieu is fascinating, and I really enjoy talking to folks who can cover all the different stuff. So I really can't thank you enough for coming on the show, and I really look forward to reconnecting and doing it again in the future.
Oh, my absolute pleasure, Tim, and it's always great working with you on Coast to Coast, and hopefully we'll do more of that in the future.
Absolutely, absolutely, my friend. So have a great evening. I'm going to throw the plugs in here. You're free to go, and I will talk to you soon.
All the best. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you. And with that said, let me do the plugs, folks. This is, of course, banalofamerica.com. That's not really banalofamerica.com. It's Banal of America Audio. And you can find out more from us at banalofamerica.com. Pretty simple, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com. You can find out more about us also on Facebook. Just punch in Banal of America. If you enjoyed this program and you want to help us out and help keep the show rolling, you can make a donation to PayPal or via our P.O. Box. The address is at Banal of America. As I say, when we ask for donations all the time, all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. I cannot plug the next edition of BOA Audio because I'm not certain about the guest. We're working on sort of settling in on one guest, and hopefully that'll come together in the next couple of days. And if not, we got a couple of other folks lined up for future episodes. There's only 4 shows left here in Season 8, and I want to make sure that each program is a home-run edition of the show. So be patient, my friends. You're not going to be waiting a month between shows, but you may be waiting a couple of weeks as I bring the very best guests to you as we close out Season 8. I do want to apologize for missing so much time. I don't know what happened. It's just the way it is here in August. Things get crazy. It has been the craziest summer I've had in quite some time. Just a tremendous amount of work and travel and things that I never would have expected coming up for me here this summer. But it's all behind me now. I've got my eye on the final 4 guests. Hopefully I can lock them all in to wrap up the season. I got an email from someone asking if I was okay, and I also got a message on Facebook from someone who was concerned that BOA Audio was over. Do not even worry, my friends. BOA Audio is not going to go out with a whimper. It's going to go out with a bang, and it's not going to be going out anytime soon. We have big plans for this program. We have big plans for the Banal of America franchise. I'm just incredibly lazy during the month of August. It seems to be an annual thing. I beat myself up last summer about it, but this summer I kind of looked around and said, well, this is par for the course. This is the way things go here. with Banal of America. And hopefully the hardcore BOA audio listeners have been very patient and can withstand the wait. And they seem to time and time again. And I really do appreciate your support, folks. You guys are awesome. As I say all the time, you are the fuel that drives the BOA mothership. Thank you so much for your enduring support of BOA Audio. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.